We come at an interesting point for the Lakeland Animal Shelter, which is located on Highway 67, the main kind of north-south route through Walworth County. You're moving into what looks like brand new headquarters, and how soon before the new place is ready to go?
Our soft opening, which will be the first day that we're open to the public at the new facility, which we're calling the Adoption Center, will be May 7th, just a couple weeks from now.
And is it premature to say that just because the signs are up and you're moving in that you've accomplished all you need to in terms of fundraising and getting things ready?
That would be nice, but that is not true. So the entire building that we've built here is approximately 14,000 square feet. What we're moving into, what we're calling the Adoption Center, and we have occupancy for now, is approximately 4,000 square feet. So we have roughly 10,000 square feet that we've built the shell of, but we still need to raise the funds to fill in and have it be able to be of use.
How much have you raised so far, and how far do you need to go?
We have raised just short of $2 million, and that is what has allowed us to build the Adoption Center and the shell for Phase 2 and buy the land and everything else that we're at here. In order to finish the entire project, we're at about $1.6 million that we need at this point to completely finish.
If you could, help me get a grasp of Lakeland Animal Shelter. It's a little different, I think, than either people's perceptions of what an animal shelter was like and what the prospects are for your visitors and guests. Tell us the philosophy here.
Okay. Sure. I think you're absolutely right. It is very different than what you would think, and I think the main reason for that is that most people, public perception is that if it's the Humane Society that is covering the entire county, and in particular animal control for the entire county, which means stray services, so a stray animal is found anywhere within the county and they come in, which is a service we provide, they also believe that shelter would not be necessarily a safe place for the animals. They believe that they would be what's called a high-kill shelter because there's so many animals coming in that you couldn't possibly be either a low-kill or a no-kill shelter. And for the Lakeland Animal Shelter, we have, as a group, and we have a very solid group of staff, volunteers, and supporters that have worked in particular in my time over the last 20 years tirelessly in order to make it so that we could be a no-kill or an adoption guarantee facility in spite of the fact that we hold the animal control contract for the entire county and take in 3,000 animals a year no matter what their condition is. I would say the biggest challenge with that is that not euthanizing animals for time or space and having an unlimited amount of time that they stay with you, basically being committed to doing everything that you can to keep them until you find the right home for them, and then finding the right home for them, which is obviously not a passive process, it's expensive. And you know, at any given time, even in the current facility, we have anywhere from 40 to 60 dogs and 300 to 500 cats. That's daily, that's a lot of cat and dog food and a lot of care. And the amount of time that goes into making sure that those animals are in a good place physically and psychologically at all times so that they're getting closer to adoption, not further away. We believe very strongly that warehousing animals is not appropriate. That's not what we're about. We're about committed to the fact that we feel there is a home out there for them. It could be 6 months. It could even be as much as we don't want it to be. It could be a year that they're with us. But we need that time to be something that's getting them closer to adoption, not further away, because they're relegated to a cage where they're not handled. Instead, for example, the dogs are handled and walked 6-7 times a day, just in one day, every dog, which that's a huge undertaking for 40 to 60 dogs. So I think we would like people just to change their preconception about what a Humane Society or an animal shelter is, and we're trying to do that.
Let's give people a sense of what life is like for those animals as they come in. What first happens to you, a paw's eye view, when you arrive here as a dog or cat? Is it primarily dogs and cats?
It is primarily dogs and cats. Roughly 2,000 cats and 1,000 dogs a year. We do take in other domestic animals, including rabbits, guinea pigs, ferrets, birds, things like that. And then we also get in stray farm animals, believe it or not. we've even had a stray cow before. But typically a lot more cats and dogs than anything else. So in our current facility, the process would be that the public, whether it's somebody that's found a dog or cat or somebody that's surrendering their own dog or cat because they can't keep them any longer for whatever reason, they would come to the current facility and come to the front desk, turn in the animal. We would get some basic information from the person. If they just found them, then it would obviously be a whole lot less information than if they've had them for a period of time. Mm-hmm. But for us, that's basic information that where they were found, if it was a stray, the person's contact information, that kind of thing. And our first goal for that animal, if it was a stray, would be to find its original owner and be able to reunite them with their original owner. Fortunately for dogs, which, as I mentioned, we roughly get about 1,000 a year, about 50% of the stray population, give or take, is reclaimed by their original owner. So those are not horrible statistics. I mean, obviously, that half of them are reclaimed by their original owner. Cats, on the other hand, it's about 1%. So we get in twice as many cats, and yet 49% less are reclaimed by their original owner. And most of what we see for cats are clearly they were owned at some point, whether they were inside, outside, or inside only. They're not wild cats. So that's frustrating. But on the bright side, 50% of the dogs are reclaimed. So after they get checked in, that animal currently would then go to one of our holding areas in the old building for cats and dogs. There's a small isolation area where they're separate from the animals that have already gone through this process and then are available for adoption. Ideally, within the first couple days, we're able to find an owner on that dog or cat. What's been helpful in the last 2 decades is the microchip system, where a lot of these animals, because that technology has been around for more than 20 years now, a lot of the animals are microchipped. And the benefit of that is, as long as the owner keeps the information current on the microchip company that holds the information on that chip, you scan the animal, chip comes up, you call the company, and the company says, that's Bob, and his owner is Tom Smith, and this is his phone number. And you call Tom Smith and say, Tom, we have your cat here, and we're open until this time. Can you come and get him? And that works out fairly well. Unfortunately, we see a whole lot less cats than we see dogs that are chipped. But it is nice technology that helps us. Anybody missing their dog or cat, we encourage them to call at any time and make a lost report. Once we get that report of what they're missing, we cross-reference with what we've gotten in since the time that they've lost the animal. A lot of times within that process alone, we're able to match them up with, for example, 2 days ago we had an older Springer that came in towards the end of the day. She had just been groomed, clearly was cared for, had an invisible fence type collar on that probably the battery was dead, and it was towards the I'm trying to remember what day this was, but it was towards the end of the day. We were surprised that we hadn't gotten a call. Unfortunately, she had a chip, but the information wasn't current, so we weren't able to trace it to an owner. But we were pretty sure that we were going to hear from an owner pretty soon because she was in such good shape and clearly cared for. And sure enough, they called the next day, and we were able to match her up, and she went home, which is great. We are not able to match them up within the first 24 to 48 hours, we still go through the process of doing everything that we need to protect them from the environment that they're in. And what I mean by that is if they've come in as a stray or a surrender that isn't current on vaccinations, we go through and do their basic vaccinations to protect them from the others that are in the population that they're in, because they may or may not have ever been exposed to just the basic things that are out there that dogs and cats are going to get sick from if they're unvaccinated. So we go ahead and do that as quickly as we can. Ideally, they end up being reclaimed, and that's not a big deal that it was done. But if they don't get reclaimed, then they're already on the path of being closer to adoption.
Do you get a sense of relief from the pets right away, or does it take them a while to get used to the idea that they're at least safe, they've got a shelter over their heads, and they're with loving people?
That's a good question. I would say that usually people think of, when you think of a shelter an impoundment facility or a pound, as people will call it, they think more about dogs than cats. They think of it as more of traditional housing for unclaimed dogs and think that the dogs have an issue with being stressed. Actually, we see more relief and just adjustment from most of the dogs that we get in than from the cats. The cats almost immediately, especially if they were surrendered, if they went from the couch to the cage, they know right away, and they're very unhappy about it, so they're pretty stressed. So it's a lot of the work that we do is constant monitoring of their emotional well-being, their psychological well-being, because that all factors in, just like it does for us, and how they're doing.
How do you calm a cat? What is the cat equivalent in your line of work of walking the dog?
It's time and attention. You know, and sometimes it's quiet and separation. You know, some have gone from being on a couch and on someone's lap to being in a room full of 200 other cats that they're separate from in their cage, but they're still in a room with 200 other cats. Very stressful. Some of them just need some privacy and some time to decompress and realize that as much as they don't like it, the situation isn't going to change and they have to make the best of it. Part of our job is figuring out what they need most and when they need it. If we were to force ourselves upon time and attention upon a cat that's saying no thank you, that's going to end badly. So we try not to do that, at least not more than once. You learn pretty quickly to not do that. So for us, it's really important. We have staff members that average staff member has been with us for at least 5 years. And we have an amazing core of volunteers that the dedication of these people, actually staff and volunteers, humble me daily, because we have volunteers that work all day at our boutique at Nine Lives in Lake Geneva, then come over and walk dogs for 2 hours and have full lives, families, everything, and still manage to do those things that on a daily basis, which is just astounding. But it takes that kind of volunteer and staff that have been with us long enough to really know what these animals need, and that kind of training is really important. If we had a high turnover of either, that would be really difficult, because obviously in the nature of what we do, there's a high turnover of animals. It helps to not have that high turnover of people, although we're always accepting new volunteers, and we're particularly excited about having new volunteers be able to have more space to do things as we move into the new facility. That's probably the biggest deficit of the current building. We've taken everything that in the original design was supposed to accommodate people having space, and we've put animals in it. So the animals really are well cared for. It's just very difficult to have the people get to them. And we have an amazing group of volunteers and staff that persevere and do that anyway, but boy, is it hard. And I think it'll be interesting to see how much of a challenge it is just to do things easier in a new building. But to go back to the, you know, sort of the cycle of what happens with an animal once they're with us. And
intake, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, that's actually the exact appropriate term. The next thing that we do is we do a temperament assessment, a formal one on the dogs. Cats, it's a little bit more a progression as you go along. You're doing more with your handling and with your medical and kind of figuring out a little bit more about their personality and what they need. Dogs, we actually have a formal temperament assessment that we do within 72 hours of them coming in. And what that is for us is it's not a pass-fail of you're adoptable and you're not. It's actually a gauge of where they would be most appropriately placed. So, for example, if it's a dog that is highly reactive and stressed at new situations and loud noises and activity, we're going to recommend that they not necessarily go to a house with 15 teenagers in and out every day and or very small children and things like that. They're just kind of gauges for us of what would work. In particular, that's going to factor in and be helpful in our new structure with our new building, because with the adoption center being all that we had the funds to build, the adoption center and the shell for phase two, the very, very basic thing that that means is that the large dogs are still going to be over at the old building. Incoming cats and other populations will be over there as well, but the hardest thing will be that that's actually not a bad thing that incoming cats will be over there initially. It'd be nice to have them under the same roof, but they're not available for adoption anyway, so it's not too much of an inconvenience for everybody that they're over at another building. Dogs, on the other hand, because we don't, the kennels are in phase two. We have a small dog room in phase one, which will be really nice because currently small dogs are in the same room with big dogs and it's pretty stressful for them. But our large dogs will be over at the old building. So it's good and it's bad in the process, because now everybody's going to start here. They're not going to go to the old building at all anymore. All of the public is just going to come to the new facility. So whether they're looking to adopt, or they've found a stray animal, or they're looking to surrender, or they're looking to volunteer, whatever they've come to us for, they're going to come to the new building. So if they've found a dog or a cat and they previously came to the old building, that's going to be a little bit of a retraining to come down here. But if they're coming to adopt a dog, instead of, just for lack of any space to actually talk to people and talk about it in the current building, we are left with the best way to have people first access the dogs in the old building is walk through and see them. On paper, that sounds great. It sounds like you're getting full access to all the dogs that we have that are available for adoption. You can see them yourself. You can come back. You can ask questions and go from there. I agree, on paper, that's great. In reality, it's a horribly stressful process for the dogs because this is their home. They're in their home. They've not invited these people into their home, and yet there they are. And it's not that they aren't good dogs that are excited to see people. Sometimes it can work either way. They could be perceived as too excited to see people, or because it's their only space and they haven't had a chance to adjust to the fact that somebody's in their living room now, they can react badly to that as well. I somewhat like to liken it to if I had to meet somebody for the first time unannounced when I was walking from the shower to the kitchen to grab something in my bathrobe, that would be a tough first meeting, and I probably wouldn't be myself.
Are dogs different from cats in that regard?
Yes, I would say they are. In particular, because in the current structure, the cats are able to be in a free-roaming area already in the old building. So they're, although some may not be as accepting as new people coming in, there's enough places that they can get up and away that it's still on their own terms, as opposed to a dog that previously had his own space and it was his 4x6 kennel space that he was waiting for the next time that a volunteer or staff member came to interact with him, take him outside, play with him, and now he has a family of seven standing in front of him and pointing and asking questions. Well intended, love the family of seven. I have six kids myself, so not disparaging family of seven. It's just, it's a really rough way to meet them. And then talking about the family, it's loud, it's scary, it's really difficult to have families in there and not have it be a really scary process for kids. So we're excited about the fact that even though it's going to be a challenge of figuring out how we logistically get dogs from the old building to the new building until we have the rest of the funds to build phase two, it will be nice in that the adopters will come here. They'll give us just a brief, you know, what's your family like? How many people are in the household? What are you looking for? They'll meet with an adoption counselor, and based on that quick 15-20 minute discussion, they'll give them a couple options of dogs to meet. Those dogs will be brought over from the old building and they'll be able to meet with them and hopefully make a match. If not, you keep going and meet some more. what we're hoping that does for the dogs and the people is the first impression is a lot better than the one that they're getting now. So in that way, it's just another reason that we're really excited for the new building. But the temperament assessment in particular is going to be key with that, because part of we use that as a gauge for sort of what they're looking for. Are you looking for a dog that anybody can walk in your house at any time and they're just going to be happy as anything? Are you looking for a dog that is going to be more reactive when somebody walks in the house? Those are things that we are able to tell kind of on the temperament evaluation, and sort of helps us narrow down. So with this building, it'll be a lot easier to use that even more so. So we're excited about that.
I imagine it is extremely important that the first call you make if you find a stray animal is to be to the shelter. You have such a matchmaker role that I have seen myself in action several times over the past few years, where it's just amazing how either you're the agency calling or you're the place to call to find that pet.
Absolutely. We will recommend your second call be to the police department, or to, if you're on a bordering area around the county, another humane society. But if you live in Walworth County and you've lost an animal, absolutely your first call is to the shelter. And we will take the full information of what you're missing, how long it's been missing, everything. One of the nice things that we've seen over the last couple of years in our industry is how social media has really worked to... A lot of times, by the time somebody brings a stray animal to us, they've already posted to 5,000 people that they found this dog, and it really helps that an hour after the dog gets to us, somebody has Facebook messaged somebody else saying, hey, I just saw Bob's dog, is at the shelter, and all of that. But same thing, if Bob, the second he, Bob probably didn't know his dog was missing, but the second he did, if he made the report, it just helps us minimize the stress on the animal too, because if they can get checked in and checked out in the same 20 minutes, that's great.
I saw an example of that just the past week. Somebody I know who is an advertising director with one of the papers in town posted that his little dog had been hit by a truck, not so seriously that the dog wasn't mobile, and ran away. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden, instantly, within 5 minutes, 22, I'll help you look, where can I find it?
Yep.
And then a short time later, the dog was found.
Yeah.
Is that one of the best parts of the job, when you see that family reunited, or when you get that call for that dog or cat that's looking at you with big eyes, where's my future?
It absolutely is. Being able to reunite a lost animal with a family that truly loves them and is missing them is absolutely one of the most amazing parts of what we get to do. And that's how I look at it. That's how our staff looks at it. That's how our volunteers look at it. We are blessed to be able to do what we get to do every day. Yes, there are times that it's discouraging and there's negative situations and you're sad for a situation that an animal is in. But more than anything, because we have the support of the community and our donors and our volunteers and our staff, we're in a position where we could take that bad situation and turn it into something else. So the converse of that, with reuniting them with their owner, if they've been surrendered for whatever reason, if they have not been reclaimed and were able to take that animal that maybe came in not such a great situation, they needed a lot of medical care, or they needed a lot of socialization, or they just, you know, didn't have anywhere to go, and being able to match them with the family that maybe they've just lost their dog or cat and didn't think they were going to adopt again, but then they saw this animal and went, you know what, we need to adopt again, and there's a hole in our life that isn't going to change until we take another family member on. And seeing that and just the difference it makes, that's huge.
What are some of the amazing physical recoveries that you've seen? I, for instance, saw something that I think went viral on the internet, where somebody found a little cat that looked absolutely frozen and motionless.
Mm-hmm.
And took her inside and warmed her up, and then all of a sudden, within 4 or 5 minutes, one eye was open, and both eyes were open, and then, you know, 2 hours later, running around just as fine as can be. Do you see some remarkable physical transformations as well as the care is taken? And don't count any animal out, I guess, is the Lakeland pledge.
It absolutely is. Everyone, no matter how desperate the situation looks when they come in, is worth trying and seeing what we could do. The example that I use time and time again is actually a dog that my family ended up adopting, but she came into us in 2008. She was left at our front door with two cats that were in deplorable condition too. She had almost no fur on her entire body, just looked miserable and couldn't see. Her eyes were completely infected. Her ears were completely infected. She just looked miserable. And yet she came out of the cage, and we actually had videotape of it because we were documenting it, and in particular it always struck me when I watched it over and over again. This animal could not have been more miserable. As far as she had to be so uncomfortable, so itchy, everything, and had been neglected of care for years. And yet when she came out of that carrier and I touched her, her whole body wiggled. She couldn't contain herself. She was so excited just to be touched and just to have somebody paying attention to her. And if we took her as an example and just looked at her and said, oh, you know, you look so awful, you look so miserable, we should just put you out of your misery. Right. And instead of taking the cue from her and saying, you know what, yes, she's miserable, she's in a really bad situation and she's not had care, but she's not given up. Because when I touched her, she went, hey, thank you, you're touching me, you're loving me, you know, I'm kind of in a bad situation, can you help me? And that's what we do, and that's what we did. And in her case, she ended up having quite a few environmental allergies that had been untreated for years. We did, there was an owner that we found with her, not that the person was taking responsibility or taking her back, but there was a long history of allergies that were untreated. It was not an easy road back for her, about a year and a half or so, but it was doable. She was in, and because she was in, we were in. And my family actually fostered her for the care, and we fell so in love with her that we just couldn't part with her. She had to be part of our family, and she still is. She's 15 years old now, and completely blind and completely deaf because of the issues of the untreated issues before. But still, she is grateful for every day, and we're grateful for every day that we've had with her. And she's my, on days where I think maybe a little less positive than others, I remember Lindsay and think about just, you know, as long as they're in it, which their ability to not give up and forgive and trust, she had no reason to trust a person. The person that was her person let her down in almost every way. Hmm. And yet she didn't know me from anything and came out of that cage going, I trust you. You're going to take care of me. I just know it. We take that responsibility very seriously.
I'm of the philosophical opinion that, although you aren't necessarily going to be able to discuss, physics or philosophy with a dog or cat, the one thing that they can speak is the language of thank you. You rescued me. Do they know? Absolutely. Do they know and express it?
Absolutely. I think they. The gratitude is definitely something that we could learn from them. Gratitude and forgiveness. Their ability to not hold on to those things, I think, is something that we as people could really benefit from. And they are grateful for everything that they're given. And when what they're given isn't great, they're forgiving of it. And I think if we spent more time trying to learn lessons from them instead of trying to teach them lessons, not that basic obedience isn't a good thing for your dog, but we could learn a lot from them. We really could. Absolutely.
From time to time, I open up the paper and I will see a page that you have out listing some of the animals. I'm amazed that they all have unique and distinctive names. How does that happen that you're a name, not a number here, and how do you go about picking the names? They're wonderful names, all of them.
It is a bit of a challenge. Now, some of them come with the names because they were surrenders, or we were able to find some information on them even if they weren't reclaimed by their owner. So we definitely can't take credit or responsibility, whichever way you want to look at it, for all of the names. But if we do find that they have a name that just is not not a positive portrayal of anything, we will try to change it to something that's a little bit more positive, but they can still understand, and it doesn't a dog named Vicious is even even if it's a 2-pound Chihuahua is not a very positive name. So we're going to try to change that to something that they could still understand and connect as themselves, but not be calling them Vicious. But as far as the animals that don't actually have names, our staff and volunteers spend a little bit of time getting to know them, and the names are usually based on personality traits and things like that. Sometimes we have fosters, in particular foster homes, that will our kitten population does much better in a foster home than they do in the shelter environment. So we try to find foster homes that are willing to take moms and kittens, or moms that are pregnant and then have the kittens and have them come in for adoption and all that they need, spaying and neutering and everything before adoption, but to have in their home for that critical period of 8 to 10 weeks from the time that they're born. Our fosters, there's some that have multiple litters at a time and, you know, maybe do 10 or 15 litters a season. So they have a tendency to run out of names quicker than anybody else, and sometimes they'll follow themes like the Disney group, or, you know, the Mexican food group, or it's kind of cute to sometimes see their themed names. But I would say, generally speaking, that the staff and volunteers spend such an amount of time and energy getting to know the animals that the names really have more to do with their personalities and their features than anything else.
You mentioned 9 lives, and I had the pleasure of going in there the other day when I was walking around downtown Lake Geneva, a wonderful resale shop. Mm-hmm. How does that work? How did it come about?
Sure. We opened the resale shop, 9 Lives, in 2007. We actually got the idea from another humane society. Elmbrook Humane Society opened theirs maybe a year before that. It was called Well-Bred Bargains up in Elmbrook. And the business model, basically everything is donated. High-end resale, designer clothing, jewelry, house furnishings, housewares, and some artwork and things like that.
It's high quality stuff. All of it.
It absolutely is. We have people that have been in multiple times as shoppers, and they have no idea it's resale. And just think that it's an eclectic group of items that changes every time that they're in. But so it's donated items, and then they are resold for a profit, and that helps. Initially, it helped with our operating expense budget. And in the last couple years, we have been successful enough with our operating expense budget, with our fundraisers and our monthly membership program and things like that, that we've actually been able to set the profits aside from 9 Lives and put it towards our new building. So that's been really nice that we've been able to do that. But the key to the success of 9 Lives is the fact that it is daily operated by volunteers. So we are not paying for staff members to be over there to run it. It is volunteers that, and it's not just volunteers that maybe excel at resale or retail. We certainly have those as well. But it's volunteers that are passionate about what we're doing at the shelter. So when a customer walks in, they not only are helpful to them with the items that are there, but they're helpful as far as conveying our message of why it's important that they're doing what they're doing. And that's, as I mentioned earlier, we have some volunteers that truly will spend their day over at the boutique doing retail sales and then will close down over there, come over and walk dogs for 2 hours, then go home and take care of their families. So
one of the few organizations where you can get both a coach purse and a pooch or a cat.
Yes, and we have several of the volunteers actually volunteer to come pick up a dog or cat before their shift. So when you go, not only do we welcome people to bring their own animals with them shopping, but we usually have on several days during the week, a dog or cat that's available for adoption that's visiting for the day over there, which is really nice.
Tell me a little of the history of the Lakeland Animal Shelter. How did it come to be the shelter for Walworth County versus the, you know, County Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals or whatever? Because I've never understood public versus private and what the interrelationship is.
Right. Well, historically in Wisconsin, most of the humane societies, or for lack of a better explanation, the entities that are doing stray services, what's traditionally known as animal control services, are private facilities and have been for 50 years or so. The only exception to that has been in the last decade or so, where when Milwaukee, which was known as Wisconsin Humane Society, stopped doing animal control for Milwaukee County and made the philosophical decision that they were no longer going to do that and they were just going to go to intaking what they chose to intake. Milwaukee County, due to its size, had to build another facility to deal with just their stray population. So that is a government-owned and operated facility that deals with stray services. Right now, that's the only one in the state that is government-run. Whereas in other states, like Illinois, most of the animal control facilities are actually government agencies. For the Lakeland Animal Shelter in particular, our history, in 1925, the Articles of Incorporation were written and accepted for the Walworth County Humane Society. I get this a little backwards in my head, so I want to make sure I've done this historical research, and we have one current donor and volunteer that is one of our founding members. So she is my source for history, too, which is very helpful. But so that was 1925, Walworth County Humane Society. There's not a whole lot of history between 1925 and the 1960s as far as being able to trace back to that, but presumably stray services of some kind were provided by that entity. In 1968, the Articles of Incorporation for the Lakeland Animal Welfare Society were written. And that was a group that was a private organization that came together, saw what was happening as far as animal control and care of homeless animals in Walworth County, and felt like something else had to be done. It was not a humane situation. Danny Burlington, who is my historical reference and the volunteer that I mentioned earlier that helps me with these things, brings it in particular to light when she tells the story that their first fundraising to build the current facility had to do with literally fundraising to people to be able to tell them that they were fundraising so that animals could be euthanized humanely, because the care was so poor previous to that that euthanasia or a humane death was better than what was happening with them. That's how bad the situation was. So that group got together in 1968 and formed. Shortly after that, I shouldn't say shortly because it took them about a decade, which is not bad seeing what they were trying to do and what they were up against. They were able to raise the funds, purchase the land, and build the facility that we're currently at. That was built in 1979 is when they moved into there. And then in 1985, the Lakeland Animal Welfare Society and the Walworth County Humane Society officially merged as nonprofit organizations. The success of that was basically that the Lakeland Animal Welfare Society was taking over the care of homeless animals for all of Walworth County, which was a huge victory. Walworth County Humane Society was no longer after that, and it all became Lakeland Animal Welfare Society. The building somehow in that process within that period or shortly after became known as Lakeland Animal Shelter. So the actual nonprofit is still Lakeland Animal Welfare Society. It's a little bit confusing, but it's all in the same. Lakeland Animal Shelter is sort of the facility, but that's how it came to be. And we have been providing animal care services for all of the county and beyond since then.
Kristen, how did you, a mother of six, get involved in this? Was this what you wanted to be when you grew up?
That is an excellent question. Well, I wasn't a mother of six when I got involved. I was a mother of none. I did my undergraduate degree in biology. I met my husband at college, he and I graduated the same year. We graduated in May. We got married in July, and that was at a school in upstate New York, an area that he was from, and I just went to school there. I'm from Southern Ohio. Graduated from college in May. We got married in July. We moved out to this region in August. And my intent for my biology degree, from the time I was in third grade on, I wanted to be a veterinarian. That just always felt a connection with animals and enjoyed working with them. And as at that time, when you connected with animals and wanted to have a professional career associated with animals, of course you were going to be a veterinarian. So that was my intent, still was after graduating with my biology degree. The main thing that I needed, in addition to my undergraduate degree, was more hands-on animal experience. I had interned with a couple vets, but really needed a whole lot more experience. So my husband and I actually moved to this area because he was an outdoor rec major and had applied to jobs across the country that were within an hour or so of a vet school. And the best offer that he got was at a camp in Illinois, and that's where he took the job. We landed in Walworth County because it was actually between where his camp was and the vet school in Madison. I had never stepped into a humane society in my life. Grew up in suburban Ohio. We had a cat. We had hamsters. But I had not been touched by homeless animals or had any knowledge whatsoever of an animal shelter or really what it was. I don't know if I'd even heard of one at that point. I probably had. But it really hadn't touched my life. In any personal way. When I was returning the U-Haul for the move, I was on 67 heading towards, I think it was probably a place in Elkhorn, and saw a sign, Lakeland Animal Shelter, and the marquee said, "Help Wanted." Thought, oh, it's an animal shelter. That's hands-on animal experience. So after I returned the U-Haul, I stopped in and I filled out a job application for the animal caregiver position that was available. Went on home after that, got home, had a message on my answering machine that said, you know, hey, can you come back and interview for the job? Started a couple days later in an animal caretaker position. I loved it from day one. I mean, just what I was able to do with the animals, and it just was where I was supposed to be. Situations changed over that first year that I was there, where I was offered the job as doing the medical position, which at the time, unfortunately, really didn't exist. There wasn't a whole lot of medical intervention that was going on with the animals. And then shortly after that, there was a lot of restructuring that went on within the organization, and myself and our current humane officer, Cindy Roble, were the only current staff members that were dissatisfied enough with sort of the status quo of operation that we took a stand to say, you know, people that are opposing this, we agree, we're in here, and we think it could be done better, and we think there could be a better situation for animals. That is what happened, where there was a complete turnover, where Cindy and I were, after a new board took over, truly the only staff members that showed up to work the next day. Shortly thereafter, the new board asked me if I would act as the interim shelter manager, to which I said, do I have to? I loved what I was doing, but definitely more of an Indian than a chief by nature, and was quite happy in that position and not looking to direct or manage or do any of that. Still at that point probably was looking to still go on to vet school. And for lack of truly anybody else that knew one end from the other, and Cindy knew the front end of the shelter as far as the front office. She was the office manager at the time, so she took that, and I took the other, and that was 18 years ago. probably 5 or 6 years later, I took the executive director position. And there are difficult days, but there isn't a day that I go to work or think about work that I'm not grateful for what I get to do every day. It's just amazing. Everything that I ever wanted to do as a vet and more, I'm able to do on a daily basis. And for me, it's just as much about the people as it is the animals. So the people that I get to touch with volunteers and staff, with adopters, with donors, that just means the world to me.
Kristen, thank you for being on.